is The Unseen. And I'm your host, Mike Cleland. Jennifer Sedini is an oracle card reader and healer. I first heard Jennifer on Stuart Davis's podcast, Artists and Aliens, and it was a two-part set of interviews, and I knew right away that I wanted to talk to this woman. These two shows from Stuart are highly recommended, and they are linked in the show notes. In that set of shows, Jennifer described her healing work and how it is connected to her own deep immersion into spiritual practices and traditions. She's also had a lot of profoundly mystical experiences, as well as a few UFO sightings. Now, given the direction and dedication in her life, those UFO events seem to play a pivotal role. Those UFO events seem to play some important role. And this intrigued me. She is a healer, and UFOs have been part of her journey. And like so many of us, Jennifer has her own podcast series. It is titled Radio Amenti, and I listened to a bunch of these episodes to prepare for this interview. These were conversations she hosted with psychics, healers, tarot readers, and visionaries. And many of the people she talked with were younger, and these shows, for me, were so refreshing. They covered heavy topics, yet they are fun and inspiring. So, again, I'm going to recommend anyone listening now to go seek out her podcasts. And 2 years ago, Jennifer published an oracle deck, and this was in partnership with artist Natalie Miller. The deck is called Amenti Oracle, Feather, Heart, Deck, and Guidebook. And during this episode, we do an oracle reading, and this shows up in the second half of the show. And upcoming, in December, she'll be publishing a new book titled Everyday Amenti, a guided journal for cultivating a feather-light heart, and this is based on her Amenti oracle deck. Again, I'm going to recommend the two-part set of interviews on artists and aliens. There is some overlap with Stuart's interview and my interview here, but together, these paint a rich portrait of Jennifer and her work and experiences. This conversation was recorded on Thursday, October 8th, 2020. Please enjoy. Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
I heard you through an interview you did with Stuart Davis, and I knew very little about you. And I was really struck by that interview, and I knew right away that I wanted to talk to you. You said a few things, and Stuart did not follow up on those. And so that is partially the whole reason I'm doing this now, is to follow up on a few things that he didn't. I was genuinely curious. But before we start, like, rather than beginning it at the, you know, sort of in your childhood and what brought you here, I really want to know, like, what are you doing right now as far as work and what you would feel is, I guess, sort of your mission in a way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So 2020 as a whole has been a year of chaos on a global scale, macro, micro. I think we're all feeling it so much. And the last few months in this kind of chaos portal that we've been surfing through, I've been really connecting deeper to my practice of meditation and diving deeper into the mind to really just find presence through a really uncertain moment in history. And I found that it's been really deeply effective for my creative process and work, which is ultimately, you know, everything that I'm doing. I try to synthesize through art, creativity, ways to kind of tickle the imagination and inspire. And ultimately, a lot of it's leading up to. So in December, I have a 52-week guided journal coming out that's based off of the 7 Hermetic Principles, the 3 Alchemical Principles, and the 42 Ideals of Ma'at. So right now, I think everything that's been swirling has been preparing for this new release into the world.
Okay, and you are doing... Well, we talked briefly beforehand, so I know the answer to this, but you had been doing oracle readings for people, and you've taken a step back from doing that as far as the way you were doing your work?
Yes. So, you know, my grandmother taught me how to read oracle cards when I was really little. I was like 8 years old, and it's been a part of my life forever. You know, in high school, I was always like the kind of like parlor trick people would want to bring to parties and be like, wow, Jen can do really amazing readings. And then in the summer of 2014, I was doing oracle card readings professionally, working out of a paranormal bookshop, doing a lot of events, and I had this moment. I take this work very seriously, right? Like, beyond the fact that my grandmother taught me how to read oracle cards at a really young age, I've always been a precognitive dreamer, hyper intuitive. I am resistant to use the word psychic because I think all time is happening at once, and you know, you're getting little glimpses of potential when you're tapped into your intuitive space. So all that to say, you know, I was working in this bookshop with a person that, you know, she said, I'm skeptical, I don't believe any of this stuff. It was very much like a money grab for that person. So it became very disenchanting for me. And one night she had invited me to a seance that she was hosting. So she would do these monthly seances, and this is somebody hosting a seance that says she doesn't believe in any of it. And I just sat back and witnessed this person lie and take advantage of people. And it just made me so angry that I was like, I'm never going to charge for this work. So
Oh,
then and
how
there I
interesting.
stopped.
Okay. So you felt this was a charlatan doing the
Yes,
séance.
completely.
And that's the minefield in this realm, is that, you know, there are charlatans out there, and there are people, even if they're not charlatans, they're, I guess, kind of inflating themselves, or their ego gets in the way of what could be legitimate good work.
Completely. And, you know, I don't want to be judgmental, but being in this space, you know, I've worked in this realm of media for the last 7 years, but my whole life has been this journey of intuition and ineffable realms. And it's very easy to see when somebody's in it for the wrong reasons. You know, we all have to make a living, and I don't think there's inherently anything wrong with an energy exchange for a service. You know, you're providing a service, there should be a compensation, but when you're lying or causing harm or doing it just to elevate the ego, I think that's really dangerous territory.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sort of coming from my own issues. I've written some books about my own experiences and about my research, and like, I worked hard on those, and I like getting paid, and I want the books to be successful. And there's this push and pull. There's this tug. I mean, I was born and raised in Michigan, and there's kind of this Midwestern kind of like, oh, don't you dare try to be the center of attention kind of headspace in the culture I grew up in. So yeah, I'm completely aware of that tension.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's important to always kind of keep yourself in check, you know? Like, thank you for showing me how not to be, but to also know that, you know, you are doing an important work when you are in this space, because there's so many people that are on a path and feel lost and need that guidance or confirmation. And ultimately, I think through even doing readings professionally and teaching and writing about all this stuff, like my ultimate goal is to empower people to find liberation through their own path, you know. And a lot of these kind of charlatans, I think they just keep wanting them to come back for more, and it's like becomes a Svengali kind of control, and that just, it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, that's the role of the teacher, is to liberate the student and create more teachers. Now, would you call yourself a healer?
In some ways, you know, I always am apprehensive to give myself any title. So even when you ask, like, what would you call yourself? I'm like,
Well, it's okay. You're allowed to, wiggle out of whatever. Yes, the reason I'm asking is because I have very much seen a pattern, and I need to quantify this pattern of the type of people who get in touch with me because of the work I'm doing, and the number of people who are healers is like off the charts. Like, when people contact me, I usually talk with them with a piece of paper, and I usually just write down Reiki right on the piece of paper, and then I wait for them to tell me, oh, I'm a Reiki healer. So
Yeah, I actually have my Reiki 1 certification.
I knew you would. I knew you would.
Yeah.
So I didn't need to even write it down. So.
I guess, I mean, I think one of the words that I'd use to describe myself often is like a conduit. So magnetizing the work and experiences and teachings that need to like conduct a result. I really like that term, like conduit or creative. I don't know. I get shy about calling myself anything though.
Well, and it's what's tough because I get shy about it too, like it's, I'm inherently a poor self-promoter. So, and I watch people get ahead in the game and I'm like, ooh, those people are good self-promoters. It doesn't necessarily make their product any different or better than someone else's,
Totally. Yeah, I had a friend last summer. He was saying, we're talking about social media and stuff, and he's a journalist, like blue verified check mark on Instagram. He's like, oh my gosh, he's like, you should have way more followers than you do. He's like, you should really put like witch in the title. And I'm like, I don't ever want to call myself that because I'm not, I feel like that's been a bastardized term that's used as like a marketing technique. And it's like, no offense to the witches out there, but like, I don't want to have become a hashtag for marketing purposes.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Yeah. Hey, when I sent my initial email to you, I really didn't know anything about you. I just was like, ooh, we got to talk. That was my sense. And I said that I was working on Whitley Strieber's network. And then you replied right away and said, ooh, you read Communion. Mm-hmm. And it had a big impact on you. And when did that happen? What was your experience of reading that book?
So it's funny because when I was little, I always was just so fascinated by the idea of like extraterrestrials. So I loved ET. When I was really young, I used to have my mom tell me ET stories every night about, aliens coming to visit me and assist me. And I always felt such comfort in it. And I had to be in first or second grade, very, very young. And I remember seeing the cover of that book, whether it was in a library. I wish I had the memory, but it just hit me so hard. There was this familiarity, being that young, being like first or second grade to see something in like that cover is really intimidating as an adult, but to find comfort in it. I just remember like picking up the book and I have my copy and from that time. And I read it. I was like a young prodigy reader. I read it.
You were 10?
Yeah. I was
when you read that book?
Really, really little. Yeah. And I remember like watching the movie and Whitley Strieber, I just always felt this connection to him and the way he spoke about the experiences with the other. And yeah, I mean, it's been a guiding light on my journey and I've reread it so many times. My copy of the book has, this is Jenny's copy of Communion written in like little kids' words. I mean, it's crazy.
Wow. Okay. So, wow. That does. So now, so you felt comfort in that cover.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt like, oh, there it is. There you are.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like I'm doing research and I'm completely like, I've just given up everything. I've like gone full force into this research. It is rewarding in every single way except financial. And I am, so I'm interacting with people all the time and I cannot tell you how many times I have heard people basically say like, oh, in around 1987, I was walking through the grocery store. I saw this book and basically fell to my knees in astonishment that face was on the cover. That is such a consistent point where I will cautiously say this because like, I would say that that cover on that book was orchestrated by an intelligence specifically to have the experience that you and so many people had, seeing that cover and having that like almost an awakening experience.
Completely. Yeah, because that cover can either terrify or excite or cause a familiarity. And it's funny also, you mentioned people that you've spoken with having that experience. A lot of my friends also, we've found this common thread where they've seen it and it's like an activation. So I do believe it's some hidden hand was guiding it as like this like initiation tool.
Yeah, activation, that's a perfect word, yeah. Because that's the implication is that all these people have had experiences that are repressed or hidden or somehow stored away in their subconscious. And that book is a trigger to look into their personal life experiences.
Completely. I would agree with that.
Hey, we're at about the 15-minute mark. Let's take our very first break. For free listeners, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure, unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff. Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as a Kindle, as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and as also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on Audible.com.
We are back on The Unseen with my guest, Jennifer Sedini, and we are talking about her life experiences and her present work as a conduit for people's healings and for people to, I guess, just better understand themselves. How did I do? Did I do okay?
Yeah, I think that's really good.
Okay, good, great. We talked about the cover of Communion and you reading that book as a 10-year-old, which I find remarkable. You had a powerful UFO sighting on a beach, and I would love to hear that story.
Yeah, so that summer was an interesting summer. It happened that same time frame where I was working in the bookshop and kind of witnessing the charlatan and a lot of high strangeness over that time. So at the time, I was dating somebody who was a tour manager for this band, and you know, he had been gone a lot, and he had a free weekend where, you know, I hadn't seen him in a month, so we decided to get together some of our friends, go down to the beach and just hang out and maybe like have some beers and have a good time. So as soon as we got to the beach, cops came and they're like, you can't drink on the beach. We got a ticket. And we're like, well, okay, fine. Can we just hang out anyway? So we hung out completely sober. And at that time, I was really into the work of Stephen Greer. So I had the CE5 contact app on my phone, and somehow we start talking about all that stuff. And I was playing the crop circle tones on my phone and talking about Stephen Greer stuff.
Whoa, what are, I have to interrupt, what are crop circle tones?
So apparently, according to Greer, some of the crop circles emit a certain frequency and vibration. And in these recordings, you hear them and they're really interesting. They're just like almost sound like weird bug sounds. You know, if you know like nature sounds to fall asleep to, right? Like think about like in the rainforest or in the jungle, like the clicking of a cicada or I don't know how to explain it other than that. It's like this weird supernatural natural sound. Mm-hmm. But they're on the app. So part of the CE5 app is there's the crop circle tones, and then they talk about the CE5 meditation protocol. But I was just playing the tones, talking about the work, and just we got into this big conversation about the universe. So as we're talking about all of these things, all of a sudden we look into the sky and see these two beautiful orbs appear. And we're like, oh my God, do you see this? And all of us are looking to the sky like, whoa, this is crazy. They start moving in this way that is so phenomenal, where it looked like, you know, one would move up to the left, the other would move to the right. It felt like they were dancing. And this was going on for about 15 minutes, and we're just all watching it completely enjoy, like, wow, this is wild. I can't believe we're seeing this. It feels like they're dancing for us. It feels like they showed up for us. And then I'm in this, like, well, oh my God, these crop circle tones work. And then I start talking about, like, you know, if they do respond to higher consciousness, here we are. We're all hanging out. We're all laughing. We're all in this lightness of being. There's six of us on the beach. Everybody's happy. Maybe there is something to this. So as this is happening, there's this beautiful, like, lightness that's washed over all of us too, of just feeling so happy. But then the conversation turned and somebody had asked about, well, you know, aren't there different alien races? Aren't there some that are, like, more nefarious? And, you know, my ex was like, well, there's the reptilians, Babylonian Brotherhood, whatever, talking about all this stuff. And as he says that, we look up and this person and I at the same time go, oh my God, do you see this? And a gigantic black, somewhat translucent triangle silently hovers over us, and we just feel this wave of terror that I can't even explain fully. And all of us are like, oh my God, we need to get out of here. And when you think about the size, you know, to try and give it context, like, bigger than a stealth bomber. I mean, this thing was humongous and just silently levitated over us and then went off into the horizon.
Well, let me just ask one thing. You said semi-translucent. What do you mean?
So it looked almost like a black mirror. So imagine, like, a black, but like a mirror. So it almost was like reflecting the surface that it was around. So maybe translucent isn't the right word, like reflective.
Okay. Did it seem like a physical thing, or were you looking at some sort of like a hologram?
It felt like a physical thing.
Okay,
it
great.
It felt like
great, okay.
A legitimate, like, a, imagine a double the size of a stealth bomber, but black, reflective, silent, just hovering over our heads. And then the shockwave of terror comes through all of us. The person and I that saw it at the same time were both like, oh my God, I can't believe we just saw that. And we all were like, we have to go. So we ran off of the beach, went back to my apartment, and my right arm was, even when I talk about it, it starts to tremor. But I was shaking, like a level of terror I had never felt before, because the lights felt just divine, celestial, like it was something, like it was like, was it our higher self? What is this? And then when that black ship appeared, especially after, you know, they were just talking kind of like somewhat in jest about, like, oh, there's reptilians, there's this. I, in my head, immediately went to, oh, look, now the reptilians are here, and they're, you know, they came for us.
And everyone felt the same level of fear and terror?
Yes. Yes. It was a shock wave of reverberation. And, you know, my ex and I were very much on the same journey of spirituality, and he was very fascinated by all the things I studied and talked about. Like, he called me his oracle often. And, you know, the other people that were there with us were, like, regular, just down to earth, salt of the earth people, like, always thought that he and I were, like, kind of like ungrounded and mm-hmm. weird.
Mm-hmm. That's how my family treats me. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had a really, it was interesting to have that experience with people that aren't into that kind of thing. And for them to have all felt it in such a way, it was really, really scary. And when we came back, we were all just like, oh my God, like what just happened? And then he had to leave like 2 days later to go back on tour. So that having that experience and then him being gone and then me being alone and my arm shaking, like it shook. Jake's every time I talk about it, but it shook like really bad the 2 weeks after, just because it was so terrifying. And, you know, shortly after that happened, I think I had talked about this on Stuart's podcast. I've never had a sleep paralysis where I have felt like, you know, I've had sleep paralysis before. Like sometimes on the plane, I'll fall asleep and then won't be able to move. And I don't know if it's because of like low oxygen, but I'm lucid and it's just my body's not cooperating, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So shortly after this happens, I wake up and I'm in my apartment and I'm completely paralyzed. And I hear people in my apartment looking through my things, talking about what I'm doing, what I'm writing, what I'm reading, rustling through everything. And I feel myself wanting to scream and not being able to scream, like completely a prisoner in my body. And this goes on for probably like 20 minutes of this awake paralysis, hearing people in my apartment talking about my things, rustling through my things. And then all of a sudden somebody tapped me twice on my right shoulder and I snapped out of it and was able to wake up and come to.
And there was no one in the.
When I woke up, there was nobody there.
Here, so just a couple questions about that. Did those voices sound like you were hearing them? I guess I'm going to ask a leading question. I don't know how else to ask it. Were you hearing people in the room speaking aloud, or were you hearing telepathic communication?
I heard people in the room speaking aloud. It was like being in my room with people in the room and not being able to move. You know, just it was awful.
And it sounded like normal people? Did it sound like professionals? Like I'm just going to say, like, my impression is it's like secret government people, like, sneaking into your room and going through your books trying to figure something out about you.
That's how it felt to me, and it made me feel crazy because I've never had an experience like that before. I haven't had an experience like that since. And Mike, it was legitimately as though I woke up paralyzed and there were people in my apartment rooting through my things trying to figure out what the hell I'm doing or who the hell I am, and then they were gone. It wasn't like an inside voice. It was hearing voices outside around me and not being able to do anything or move.
Let me just back up a little bit about a couple of things. I'm going to sort of put my UFO investigator hat on, and these are the kind of questions I ask. So just before you talked about the arrival of the orbs, you said that summer had been a summer of high strangeness. Now, what do you mean by that?
So the series of events was... you know, I'm working in this bookshop. My ex is out on tour. Then, you know, I was living in this apartment complex, and through random synchronicity, I became friends with this 33rd degree Freemason, and he became like a mentor to me. We met one day. I was out at the pool, and he came and sat a couple benches away from me, and he happened to have this one book that I had the sequel to. And we just started talking.
So what's the book?
It was The Secret of all books.
Okay.
So, you know, it was like a funny thing because, you know, he was reading The Secret and then I had The Secret, The Magic, and I was reading it. And I was like, oh, my God, this is so funny. I have the sequel with me. So we start talking. And one of the first questions he asked me is if I believe in angels. But he became this mentor, friend, really special person in my life. So as all this is happening, he is kind of like this mentor on the process. So then we have this thing happen on the beach, really terrified. Then I get invited to this really interesting, it's called the World Technology Network. And it was this summit where like Edward Snowden was giving a talk and people from like the UN were there. And I was the only person like me. So I'm like, why am I here?
And how did you get invited?
Through a weird circumstance where I got asked to do a speaking engagement at some festival. And I met the founder and he goes, I don't know why, but I need to invite you to this. And it turned out he's the chairman of the World Technology Network, used to work for the Clinton nonprofit sector. Lots of weird synchronicity. And on top of all of that, this is the summer that I began channeling too. So it was like this activation of so many events and high strangeness. And then beyond that summit, he had invited me again to this World Summit on Technological Unemployment, like a few months later, where we got gathered in these groups and we're writing out solutions of what to do when basically technology renders us unemployed and everything was being sent to the UN. And I'm like, again, why am I here?
Well, that's happened. We're in that right now. That's like, so.
Yeah, exactly. And this is 2014. So 6 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. So, wow, there's a lot here. So I'm going to go back to the event on the beach. In the talk with Stuart Davis, you mentioned that you had told the story to Sean Stone, and I know Sean Stone peripherally. We're acquaintances. And he, so what did he say? What did he say might be going on with that event on the beach?
Yeah. So I wound up having a lunch with him pretty soon after that had happened, still my arm shaking. And when I told him about it, he goes, oh no, that other ship that you saw wasn't like reptilians or anything. He goes, the orbs you saw, those were probably ET or interdimensional beings or something of an ineffable realm. But that black ship you saw, he goes, that's like a black budget government thing. And he goes, if you look it up, you'll see there's a common thread of people will see the orbs and then the black ship will come. And I'm like, what? And I looked it up and I'm like, wow, there's so many people that have had this experience. And there was actually even an episode of The X-Files where it was the same thing, where the orbs come and then the black ship comes. So it's part of the zeitgeist of UFO phenomena. And it was comforting in some ways, but also terrifying to be like, wow, the level of technology our government actually has is out of control.
Well, and I'll chime in on this one. Sean Stone is immersed in the research of government conspiracies and stuff. And I am immersed in the research of, you know, I don't even want to say UFOs. I would say like the outlying strangeness, the utter weirdness that seems to surround the UFO contact experience. That's what I feel like I'm focused on. So he was correct. Yes, it is absolutely common for people to say, oh, I saw a UFO. And the next thing I know, there were like military jets screaming across the sky, or these black helicopters, you know, chased it away. And that, so that's very normal. That is not uncommon. And the triangle thing is also absolutely common. But my sense is like, I don't know, like, it could be a black budget thing. I would argue that it was theater. You were presented with a theater in the experience, the same way that like someone going through a shamanic apprenticeship, you know, they would take him into the cave and then they would, you know, the villagers would have a ceremony, a metaphoric ceremony that would create or induce these emotions, whether symbolically or whatever. So my sense is you had a symbolic experience. It might have nothing to do at all with secret government. I will also say that I have felt that, I have felt with one of my experiences, me and another person together felt that same profound fear. Like, I don't know exactly what you experienced, but boy, you know, you're using the same vocabulary words I used to tell that story. Yeah. And I don't think there was a secret government craft above the tent I was in when it happened. I saw nothing. And there's all sorts of theatrical stuff that happened to me that night in this sort of dream realm. And so I don't think that was secret government stuff. But I don't know what your direct experience, but so I just want to take a couple steps back and say, like, ooh, you know, it's very tough to say what concretely what's going on in these realms or with these experiences.
I resonate with that. I'll receive that because I think in some ways you may be onto something there, because my other, you know, one of my other experiences with the UFOs over the pyramids in Egypt, you know, it was similar orbs, but a giant fleet of them. And there were so many, I couldn't even count.
We need to take our second break. But before we do, like, I don't want to get into the middle of it, because this is one story I would definitely want to address. But before I do, I just want to, let's take a couple steps back. And for me as an investigator, the questions I ask: what was happening leading up to the event? That would be the orbs and what happened after. So leading up to the event, you had the summer of high strangeness. And afterwards, you haven't said it directly yet, but you began channeling. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so you said your right arm was shaking. Were you automatic writing with your right arm?
It was a form of automatic writing. Yeah. So,
so the same arm that was shaking was...
became the arm that I would do the automatic writing with, okay. Which is, wow, you kind of just blew my mind.
Oh, come on. You must have thought of that before. Now, that was like 5 years ago or 6 years ago.
Yeah, but I actually didn't.
Because I'm a cartoonist by trade. And so my sense is if I was to draw this thing, I would draw you with your hand shaking and I'd have a little thought bubble coming above your hand saying, give me a pen.
Wow. No, you just opened up some kind of door for me. Wow.
I mean, that was my thought. Like, but so as an investigator, like, these are the questions I ask.
No, this is great.
Yeah. So that for any paranormal experience or any profound synchronicity, I would ask the same things too. What was going on in your life right before? What was going on in your life right after? So before we take the break, what was the nature or the tenor of the channeled messages?
So, well, it's very interesting because this is, again, the summer of 2014. So much that came through. First, it came through and some in Aramaic, some in Turkish. It was very celestial. And the general crux of the information coming through is that in 2019 and 2020, the Earth would undergo great changes. you know, I can pull up one of the channelings about 2019, and it blows my mind that I received this then, because it was a lot of it came through in these like really celestial riddles, but talking about how the earth is to go through changes and we're living almost in this time of prophecy. And it was, again, like almost like an initiation into understanding the time that we're in now. It's pretty wild.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So, wow. Okay. Let's now take our second break.
Sounds good.
For free listeners, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab to see our options.
We are back on The Unseen with my guest Jennifer Sudini, and we are talking about her experiences and what led to her work and her role now. Just before the break, she brought up something that happened in Egypt, and I said, whoa, let's come back and talk about that after the break. So we're back. I would love to hear what happened. And I may butt in a little bit because I really want to understand this story. You told this somewhat briefly on Stuart Davis's podcast, and I'm going to recommend everyone who listens to this one to listen to that one too, because hopefully we'll cover two separate avenues of thought. So what happened in Egypt and when did it happen?
So Egypt, through synchronicity and divine blessings, I was gifted a trip by Nassim Harriman's company, the Resonance Academy. It had happened at a really interesting time when I had just started working on my Oracle card deck, that the Amenti Oracle, which came out about almost 2 years ago. So, you know, I'm gifted this trip through synchronicity. Funny enough, in 2012, I remember having this incredible vision of meeting a guide in the pyramids in Egypt and saying, one day you'll get here and what will get you here is your mind, which is a nice aside. So this journey that we were in, you know, we are with these guides that are in the Kemetic school of thought. Like if people have watched The Pyramid Code, it's a really great show on Netflix. Those are the people that were showing us around the pyramids, right? So one of the nights we were there, we had an opportunity to spend the evening in each of the three great pyramids. And we were able to choose different time frames. And there was like over 100 people. And I wanted to be there for like the witching hour. So I chose from like 1 a.m. to 4 a.m.
So this is one more time. Like you get to spend time in the king's chamber, like all alone?
Well, it was a small group. So each group was a small group of people that got to spend time in it. So, you know, we got to go through each of the three. So the first one was the going through the king's chamber. And I remember when I walked in, it felt so extraterrestrial, like walking up the steps, getting to the king's chamber. It made me think of the film Arrival. When Amy Adams steps onto the ship and gravity shifts, and it's just this otherworldly feeling. And Nassim and the team were in the king's chamber toning. So the way the pyramids are built and the way that sound carries through has this extraterrestrial quality to it. And we had an opportunity, each of us, to lay in the king's chamber while they toned and did sacred ohms. And when I laid in the king's chamber, I had a complete out-of-body experience.
Wait, so I got to interrupt. You got to lay in the big, shiny granite sarcophagus in the king's chamber.
Yeah, that happened.
I have to ask, like, really practical things. Did you, like, take your shoes off and, like, just do it with bare feet? Or, like, what?
Yeah, no, I stepped in with my boots and my I think I was just wearing like black pants and black tank top.
Okay. Because my first thought was when you said that, I was like, oh my God, I would have to take my shoes off. But anyway, keep going.
But I would love to go back and do that and be able to take my shoes off.
Sometimes you might only get one chance in a lifetime to lay in the King's Chamber like that. So anyway, forgive me for interrupting. Keep going.
No worries. So while I'm in it, I had a complete out-of-body experience. And, you know, the Egyptians believe that the soul has all these various aspects of it. You know, if you've heard of like the Merkaba as this vehicle of light, vehicle of ascension, you know, the different aspects of the soul, you know, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around, where it's like you have the animating spirit, you have your soul double, there's all these things. But in that moment of laying in the chamber, I felt it. I was like, wow, now I understand, because I'm literally having this out-of-body experience that looks like something out of Manly P. Hall's A Secret Teaching of All Ages, like the drawings of like initiation, and I'm seeing myself outside of myself and feeling myself outside of myself. And I'm like, there's no way. These are tombs. You know, these are like initiation chambers, energy devices. Just, you know, I've worked with plant medicine, like ayahuasca, like I've had these experiences touching other realms through various modalities. And this was unlike anything. It was literally being in this geometry of this structure, and the energy within the structure compounded with sound as this scientific tool that's assisting in higher vibration, and having this out of body experience. So that had happened. And then as I'm walking out of the first pyramid, I get outside and I look up to the sky, and a bunch of us.
And this is now like 4 in the morning or so?
This is like probably around like 2:30 a.m.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'd say like, because it started at 1 and we had about an hour in each of them. So yeah. So like I'd say like about 2:30. I look up to the sky, and a bunch of us look up to the sky and see this. And we see just a fleet of orbs, like hundreds of orbs. Like if you imagine, I actually just watched my octopus teacher, which is a beautiful doctor.
Oh, I saw that too. I just saw it the other night. Yeah, I loved it.
So beautiful. But the underwater scenes of like seeing these like schools of jellyfish underwater, imagine that in the sky, just flying so fast, orbs after orbs after orbs. We're all like, oh my God, like, what is going on? And I remember looking to the guides, and they were like kind of smirked, and were like, yeah, this happens a lot. And then, you know, this goes on for probably like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20, like around that time frame. Two military planes come and fly over the pyramids. And I'm like, oh my God, that's really interesting. So they say, yeah, the pyramids are actually like a no-fly zone, but it's a common thing. The orbs come and then the military planes come. So that was really interesting.
Wow.
But it wasn't like a black triangle ship. It was like two military planes flying loudly over the pyramids.
So I know two other people, both of them who have had UFO contact experiences. One of them is Barbara Lamb, and she got to meditate in the King's Chamber and had a profound, I think it was an out-of-body experience. She's told this story many times. And Robert Stanley, who's had... I don't want to speak for him, but he certainly has had experiences that sound like UFO contact experiences. He wrote a book called UFOs Over Washington, D.C., and he had a spontaneous out-of-body experience just standing in the King's Chamber, not in the sarcophagus itself, but just standing in the room there. So so you're not alone in this.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely something to that. I actually... before this trip, in my old podcast, I had a podcast called Liberation Frequency that I did about like 23 episodes of. And I interviewed Freddie Silva, who has a book called The Lost Art of Resurrection.
Sure.
And he talked about a lot of people have that experience where they'll just see like these apparitions or specters or out of body things happening. Because, I mean, these spaces hold such powerful energy. You just feel it reverberate through every fiber of your being. So whether you see it or feel it, there's something palpable about being in these sacred spaces.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You mentioned that you have had a past life regression through hypnotherapy.
Yes.
Would you be open to talking about that?
Yeah. So, again, that weird summer.
That is 2014?
Yeah.
So I had a past life regression hypnotherapy session in 2014. So I'll just front load you with that. So anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So that happened that summer as well. by a hypnotist who's gone on to become very famous. At that point, she was just starting her business, and which is really interesting to have kind of had that gift from somebody now who's, you know, I think she's charging like thousands of dollars for one-on-one sessions. And we did it in trade. I read her oracle cards in exchange for this past life regression. So I had the regression and I saw myself so clearly looking down, seeing around me. And I saw myself in southern France, and the emotions that I had were so overwhelming. I was just sobbing hysterically. And the name that I was Sarah, and which was a weird thing having that in past life regression, because when I was really little, I was obsessed with the name Sarah. I wanted my mom to name her car Sarah. Everything had to be Sarah. And then stepping into this life in southern France and having the name be Sarah and having this overwhelm of emotions. And, you know, I saw my life. I saw my death. So basically this regression is like seeing the life that is most necessary to see now for your path in this incarnation. So when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, like, is this even real? Is this just like a figment of my imagination? Because the implications of this being my past life makes me feel crazy right now. But yeah, I mean, it's like emotional to even talk about. But it definitely added to that time frame of swirling strangeness.
And were there events in this Sarah's life that you like learned about through the session?
Yeah,
you don't have to tell if it's too emotional. Don't worry, but you just you don't have to. No pressure at my end.
I just don't. It's just like such a crazy thing to say out loud. So basically, I see myself in the life of this woman Sarah, who is in, you know, rural France in like biblical ages, like long, long time ago, and she's just sobbing hysterically over the loss of Yeshua. I didn't even know that like Jesus was ever named Yeshua or called Yeshua. And that was like in the recording, I'm just crying and sobbing about him. And I had never heard of the Essenes before, but that word came through the reading. And in her life, it was this life of a person that is mourning the loss of Yeshua and is practicing this really kind of sacred tradition. And also at the same time, so angry with humanity that she puts herself into isolation, because, you know, in the regression, you get walked through the death and you see her die alone. And whether this all was a figment of imagination or something, it really deeply affected me, because it's been this kind of thread on my own path, too, of feeling so deeply and seeing so deeply, and then all the reflections in this cosmic mirror of the charlatans of spirituality that find this thing to wear and don't embody it, or just find a way to prey on weak people and sell snake oil, and that kind of anger and wanting to isolate and all that. It's like a lot has kind of like been on my own path. So whatever it meant, it's just the implications of if that was the past life, or if we're all one and maybe just seeing a life that we're all connected to, it further kind of fed the strangeness, because then when the channeling started and words were coming through in Aramaic, which is a language I don't know how to speak, it became like, what is going on? What does this all mean?
Wow. Was it healing for you?
Very, very, simultaneously healing, but also like confusing, because you're like, oh my God, this is the implications of this are so intense. But it was like almost affirming, you know, again, like to compare it to finding communion and seeing the cover of Whitley's book and being like, oh, there you are. Having that was like, oh, there it is. That makes a lot of sense. So it was affirming and overwhelming all at once.
Wow. So I had a session in London with a woman named Lorraine Flaherty, and there's two separate episodes on Whitley Strieber's Dreamland from a few summers ago. It'd be easy to look up if you looked up Lorraine Flaherty. And I have been very open talking about this, but I have had a lifelong issue with severe clinical depression. And at times it got very bad. And at other times it was just a chronic low-grade depression. And I was, for much of my life, I feel I have functioned very poorly because of it. And I tried everything. I tried, you know, I read the Bible. I tried meditation. I was on all kinds of medications. I tried like diets. And so I went in Lorraine Flaherty. We had a little talk before it started, and she said, like, you know, so what's it, you know, what's the first, you know, the reason I went was to hopefully find some solace and help with my issues of clinical depression. And she, you know, in the little office in London, she kind of asked a few questions. And she's like, what's the feelings you get when it first starts your depression? I said, well, the first thing I lose is hunger. Like, I just had the ability to feel hungry, which is like a normal sort of lusty, passionate thing, to be hungry for food and then eat food. Like, that disappears completely. And I recognize that as a warning sign. And then I said, like, it, like, being depressed is like feeling your feet are trapped in cement.
Yes.
So a bunch of stuff came up, and I've talked about this. This lifetime appears from about the 19... God, I'm shaking all over right now. This lifetime appears from the 1920s, and I'm like an art student, a young art student, and I'm very prideful, and I'm arrogant, and I'm very skilled. I'm a very talented artist, but I'm very skilled, and I'm in the session all of a sudden... I say, something's wrong with my face. Like, something's wrong with my face. And Lorraine said that my face had swollen up. She watched my face swell up in the as I was laying in the chair. And I said, someone's beaten me. And I'm blind. And I was a young artist. And now I'm blind because I've been beaten so badly. And Lorraine says, who beat you? And I said, my father. And at that point, I sobbed uncontrollably. And I all my life, I've had a tough issue with, I've been an illustrator and I'm an artist and I've drawn all my life. And I have had a very sort of schizophrenic relationship to my role as an artist. So I don't know whether this was, again, just what you said, I don't know whether this was some sort of metaphor that I was presented with or whether this truly happened. And there's a little bit more to that, but...
Wow.
So I come out of the session and I she counts down from 10 and I open my eyes and sort of sit up in the chair and I said, was I crying? Did I cry for a while? And she said, yes. And then I said, the first words out of my mouth were, I am so f***ing hungry.
Wow.
And I am.
Wow.
I want to be clear. Like, I, for a long time, I wouldn't, like, I knew right at that moment, I knew it was gone. I was cured. And I have had such a hard time. Like saying that I don't want to make that strong statement that I was cured. Like every time I do it, all I say, knock wood, it feels like I'm cured,
yeah.
But I won't say it. And I just feel like I'm like, I had such a strong knowing that I'm cured. And I'll, so that was in, sorry. That was in 2014. I haven't had any issues with clinical depression since then, and I have not been able to say that since I was 12 years old. So,
wow.
So you know, I was on Prozac for 7 years. I've done, you know, so I, in this 2 hours in a chair, cured it.
Wow.
So sorry, I felt like I got a little, that was emotional for me to say that.
No, thank you for sharing that.
Sorry, I'm shaking a little bit. Here, I'll ask a question of you. Have you ever had any unusual experiences with owls?
I haven't with them, in the physical form, like of seeing an owl, but I find owl feathers all the time in the most random, weird, unexpected places. There's an act where you actually can't keep owl feathers because it's about.
Yeah, it's a predator. You're not allowed to have any predator feathers. Yeah,
but I'll find them constantly, which is really interesting because they always seem to appear in the most unlikely circumstances or places.
Okay. When I used to do a podcast ages ago, I used to ask a handful of questions, and how would you define a shaman or shamanism?
So for me, from my experiences with working with shamans, indigenous shaman from Ecuador and, other kind of more gringo shaman that have kind of been on this path, I think the most effective answer for what a shaman is somebody who is able to walk between worlds with grace and understanding of the light and dark nature of all things. Somebody that can, understand and discern that dreamlike reality with a level of grace that requires deep training and discipline. That's probably the best answer I'd be able to give for what a shaman is.
Okay. How would you define archetype?
So for me, thinking about archetypes, I really love the idea of using the metaphor of the major and minor arcana of the tarot. So, people ask, what is the tarot? Is it telling the future? Is it telling me I'm going to die or meet my husband? What does it mean? And I'm like, this is the best way to explain it. So in the major arcana, it starts out as the zero card, which is the fool. He's kind of blindly walking off into the sunset, about to walk off of a cliff, but blissfully unaware of this step into the wild unknown. But, starting at the fool, he goes through this life journey of coming to understand the way of the world. So everything that is met along the way are various gradients of the human soul, the blueprint of the human spirit into form. So each of us, looking at humanity or human consciousness as an archetypal form, we're each going to go through different levels of consciousness as we come to understand the way of the world, where we begin the world unaware, then all of a sudden we connect with our divine nature and realize that we can direct our thoughts. That's when we tap into the magician or the emperor, the empress, the hierophant. There are all these aspects of humanity embedded within this blueprint. So if you're thinking about an archetype, it's something that's within the zeitgeist of the human experience. As a woman, they talk about maiden, mother, crone. Yeah. Those are archetypes of what it means to be a female. But it's basically the tapestry of being a human and pulling different threads to understand yourself better, if that makes sense.
No. So and the reason I'm asking this is because you found the owl feathers. And so I asked you this right before we started the recording. I asked, do you know anything about me, as we headed into this interview? And you said no, which I thought was great, because I feel like I've been really pigeonholed as far as my research. It's my own fault. But I have been researching owls and their relationship to direct UFO contact. And I have so much information. I somehow got on this path through direct experience with owls, very mystical experiences with real owls. And I kind of put the word out and I kind of started a little blog and I asked people with owl stories to contact me. And I have been collecting, it's unimaginable the number of powerful mystical stories I have collected simply through asking the question, have you ever had any odd experiences with owls? So you told me about finding the owl feathers. Through people I've talked with and people who I trust and who would know, people on a shamanic apprenticeship, whether they become full shamans or they take on some sort of other type of healing work, will find owl feathers, or they will be confronted with owls, or they'll be confronted with owl imagery. It might be pictures of owls or something like that. But what you just described is something that happens and is well understood where people are on a shamanic path. And they will find owl feathers. That's the reason I asked. And my best definition of the role of the owl would be it's an archetype. Like it's imbued with some deeper hidden meaning that we can tap into at an internal level. We might not be able to tap into it on a conscious level, but we, just by being human, are gifted with this internal sense of knowing what the owl means and its resonant power that might be very difficult to explain consciously. So when you said that, I was like, oh. And then I asked those two questions, which I have asked a lot of people, both those definitions for shamanism as well as archetype. Mm. And everyone gives a different answer, which is fine, because those are both pretty elusive things. You know, shamanism has its own thing. So sorry, I didn't mean to hold the floor for that long. But so I'm at the point now where I've taken a couple steps backwards, and like, I feel like our society is adrift, and we need shamans. We don't have a village shaman anymore. Like, if we were turn the clock back 500 years ago when we were in South Dakota, if you had a mystical experience, you could just go to the edge of the village and ask the shaman. We don't really have that right now. But what we do have is we have people like you that people can contact for a shaman-like role. Do you feel that's fair to say?
Okay. Definitely. Yeah. I like that it's something that's needed. You know, like back in the ancient times, there's like tribal elders or councils or people to consult when you've had these like intangible experiences and want to make sense of them. And, not to be so like negative and about like the money aspect of things, but the fact that so much of it is put behind a paywall, I think kind of does a disservice because people are needing that. I think, you know, humans are such sensitive creatures and we can all feel the collective weight of the times that we're in. And it can be confusing when you go down like a click funnel of, well, this is what I need to do or this is what I need to be. And the role of the shaman is so important now, and having it be accessible even more so.
And then you finding owl feathers. To me, so what happens, people contact me and tell me these profound owl stories and they say, what does it mean? Mm. And I'm usually at a loss. I can say, here's some other stories and here's what it might mean. But when you said you were finding owl feathers, that was my gut reaction. Like, oh, you're on a path. And those are clues along the path.
I like that. And I received that because it makes sense when I was in Egypt and outside of the Sphinx, I found a feather there, which is like such an unlikely place to find a feather. And it wasn't an owl feather, but it was shaped perfectly like the feather of Ma'at, or some may pronounce it as Mayet, which is actually the Egyptian netter that my oracle deck I created is based around.
Hey, speaking of the oracle deck, would you be willing to pull a card and we can talk about that, or you can go through the process of what, you know, how you do it? And because I'm genuinely interested.
Absolutely. Just give me a moment. I'm going to get the decks for you. Okay. Great. So what I'm going to do for us is, you know, the oracle deck that I created in partnership with my illustrator and who's come to be like one of my best friends' sister on the path, Natalie Miller, they're more like affirmations. So they're based off of this Egyptian netter, Mayet, who is essentially this goddess of justice, order from chaos, balance, truth. And in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the weight of your soul is measured by your heart. And if your heart is as light as her feather, you can pass through to the next life. So when you're in the weighing of the heart ceremony, there's something called the 42 negative confessions of Ma'at. But our deck is based off of the 42 ideals of Ma'at, which are taking those negative confessions and turning them into positive affirmations. So they can be used as a tool to divine insight and to find a deeper connection, but they really work in tandem with the tarot or with other oracle decks as well. So what I'm going to do for our reading is use my grandmother's oracle deck, which is the cards that I learned from. So I'll pull four cards from there for us and then pull one from a mentee just to have it be kind of the signifier or kind of like what's going to drive the point home.
Okay.
So do you think we should do for the collective or just would you like me to pull some cards for you? What would be ideal?
My life is in transition right now. I'm going to be selfish. Let's pull a card for me.
Okay, great. So I just ask that while I'm shuffling the cards, keep your mind open, focus on what you'd really like to receive, and then I'll talk about what comes through.
Great.
Okay. So we're going to start with the cards that we received from my grandmother's deck. So grandma's deck is really interesting. There's been nothing that I've seen that is like it before or since. Try as I might, I've never been able to find the origin of these cards, but the closest style to what these cards are is called the Leonormand. So the first card that came for this reading for you was a gate opening. So, you know, you look at this gate opening to a new horizon, but there's a sense of uncertainty about what the horizon is going to offer. You know, it's this gate opening up to what almost looks like a forest or something that's like a bit nebulous, but it's new opportunity, new beginning, new opening, but an uncertainty of what that actually will be. The card that fell next to it. So throughout the deck, there are different male and female cards, and they're each looking in certain directions. Some have brown hair, some have blonde hair, some are looking to the left, some are looking to the right. So the card that is pulled next to this new gate opening, it's a female card with more like fair hair, and she's looking to the left and she's upside down. So for me, I'm sensing with like a new beginning or a new gate opening, and then this feminine card being upside down looking to the left, there's a heaviness in the heart that may need to be addressed as this new beginning is happening. Or there's a heaviness when it comes to maybe like a feminine consciousness. There is something relating to like a feminine thing that's weighing on your heart, because next to it is what these card is, it's letters. So, you know, when we're waiting for something in the mail, we're waiting for something to arrive or waiting for the answer to come to us, but it's not coming so quickly. Again, like new beginning, new opening, this feminine heaviness on the heart, but then these letters waiting, it's upside down also. So being next to the female card upside down and then having the cards being, the letters being upside down, it's kind of feeling like a holding pattern of sorts. So you're waiting for an answer to come, but the answer's not coming right away. And it's creating this kind of sense of like uncertainty of all things. And the final card of it is a gift. So the gift card represents like what your gifts are, your presence, your divine purpose. That's also upside down next to what you're waiting for. So it seems like this process of waiting, this holding pattern, this new beginning that's like right there and right there for you to happen. There's all this other kind of like uncertainty within it and almost like this stagnation of your inherent gifts that isn't flowing as much as it should be, but it's all tied to it because your gifts are what's pushing you forward. But then all this other energy kind of coming around is also like having the gifts in this holding pattern too, if any of that makes sense.
Sure. Okay.
And then the card that I pulled from my deck is I converse with awareness, which is really interesting that that's the card that we pulled since we're on a podcast, and your voice is a part of your talent that's guiding your future progress and you know, being on this network and having your podcast. So conversing with awareness, you know, you see a woman kind of speaking her reality into the world and there's a hummingbird by her shoulder. So there's this like lightness of being. So understanding the power of your word and speech and what you're putting out into the universe seems to be like a kind of thread that ties all of this together as well.
Wow, that's very nice. That's a very, very pleasant reassurance that, you know, I mean, my life is in transition. Lots of stuff is going on right now. And one of the things I want to get back into, which I haven't done for a long time, is to start drawing again. I totally was working on a handful of book projects. Everything went on hold, and I haven't really drawn anything meaningful in 6 years. So
wow. Yeah, and that's a gift that you have, you know, for that gift. You know, the beginning of the reading is a gate opening to new potential, but it's not completely seen. And then kind of some of the nebulousness in the middle, and that the gift card being upside down, being tied to whatever holding pattern this is, or this transitory pattern, needs to be right side up, because your gifts are guiding your process, but they're also in a process of
I'm totally in a holding pattern right now. I recognize that. So, and there's stuff to do in a holding pattern. I got to take care of some, you know, pragmatic stuff and business stuff and some book project stuff. And it's all very It's not very creative, the stuff I'm doing right now, but I need to do it. So it's nice to be in this holding pattern to some degree.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the way, like, with an oracle card reading works. It's like more like confirmation, or like kind of being like, ah, okay, that makes sense. You know, the tarot, we can dive deeper. And that's, again, like more like elements and archetypes. But this is just like, this is what's going on right now. Let's look at it and move past it so that the nebulousness on this other side of the gate can clear and you can see more and, you know, move whatever energy is keeping this holding pattern going so that you can have creative flow again, so that you aren't like waiting for it to kind of like inspiration to hit to just.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah. That's I get that. Yeah. So the inspiration. Yeah. I've got inspiration. I think about drawing all the time, but the inspiration thing is a double-edged sword, because you get inspired and then you get so, you know, that there's expectations involved in that inspiration. So then you kind of seize up a little bit. It's better to, like, I guess, how to say this. I always say, like, you know, drawing is like playing the banjo on the front porch, right? You know, you just kind of play it and you don't have to worry about, you're not recording it. There's nothing sacred about it. It's just going off into the ether and that's it. And that's what a sketchbook is just playing banjo on the front porch.
Yeah. And it kind of offers another layer to this, you know, the female card that came through, because it can have so many different layers to what the meaning is. But if you look at it archetypally, you know, creativity is feminine consciousness. You know, if you look from like the Kemetic mystery schools, they talk about like left brain, right brain, you know, that the creative part of the brain is considered more of like feminine consciousness. Like it's your intuition, creativity.
Yeah. And I feel like I have a very feminine side to me as far as my illustration and the role of the artist and the work I've done over the years, you know, so the teaching work I've done, I feel like I have a very feminine teaching style. So we have gone a little bit over an hour, about 5 minutes over an hour or so. How are you holding up? We can wind this down?
Sure.
Got to figure out a way to, so like, I'm just, as an aside thing, I did not expect to get, actually, you know what? I'm going to take that back. I like was worried. I knew when I brought up the past life regression, I knew I was going to get emotional. Mm-hmm. So I was.
Thank you for sharing and being vulnerable.
That's my feminine side. I'm totally, I'm pretty much at peace with talking about, you know, being depressed and abducted by aliens. So I might as well, you know, so that's fine. I'm all about being clear with my emotions and not worrying too much. People with things that involve other people, I'm very cautious about sharing those stuff about myself. Like I've been putting it all out there to my own detriment at times. So. Okay, let's bring us back in. Jennifer, this has been really remarkable. Like I did not really know what to expect with this conversation, and it was much more engaging and personal than I thought it would be. Like I choked up a little bit there and I'm fine with that. But this was a very moving conversation for me. And thank you for doing the reading too. I wanted people to know the type of work you're doing, and I thought just a demonstration like that would be a very clear way of showing that to the listening audience. Is there anything you want to share before we go? Like, just can you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so thank you, Mike. I'm so grateful that you got in touch, and this really has been a lovely conversation. I feel so, so grateful.
Oh, good. As do I.
So if people want to stay in touch with me, my website is jennifersodini.com. My oracle deck is a Menti oracle. My guided journal comes out December 1st. It's called Every Day a Menti. So it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, major retailers. I do have a podcast that I'm hoping to get back into flow with, which is Radio a Menti. But yeah, I mean, all those things you can find on my website, and I'm very responsive. So if anybody feels called to reach out, I am happy to receive your messages and to respond.
Well, thank you. This has been a delight, and it's been very emotionally rewarding for me. So my thank you is genuine. Thank you.
I echo that. It's a beautiful reflection, because I feel very, very much the same. So thank you, Mike.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
This is Mike, and I am chiming in after the editing. I said it a few times in the last couple of minutes of the show, but this was a really emotional episode for me. I cried when I shared my past life regression. And Jennifer was great, and it felt right to say that. But what it was, the source of the emotions, and I said it, but I don't think I said it very clearly. In the interview itself, I was pretty shaky, and what has been hard for me is my own cautious nature. I had this powerful experience under hypnosis, and upon waking, I knew I was cured. It was so plain to me, so clear. I knew it. Yet, in the years since then, I have been so hesitant to say it, to just say it. I would dance around it. I would give myself an out. I would say things like, I feel cured, or it seems I'm cured, or until now I'm cured. But I'm going to say it right now. That session cured me. It solved what decades of medication and therapy could not solve. Again, I have not had an episode of clinical depression in over 6 years, and I have not been able to say that since I was 12 years old. I am now 58. Jennifer and I talked for a little bit after the interview, and after the recorder was turned off, I kind of asked if I should edit out the part where I got so emotional, and she said no. And I was very quick to agree, so it's in there. I want to say that there are people out there doing healing work outside the boundaries of what we might want to call established mainstream medicine or mainstream treatments. There are people doing powerful healing work, and some of these people, perhaps many, have had UFO experiences. This is a pattern, and it tells me there is some connection between UFOs and healing. This is what I wanted to explore in this episode, that mysterious, heartening overlap between UFOs and mystical healing. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.